All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Next guest, Bob Dreyfus. He's an independent freelance reporter who his articles appear in The American Prospect, in Rolling Stone magazine, Mother Jones, The Nation, and on TomPaine.com. He's got a new book coming out called Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, which will be published this fall. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to talk to you again. We spoke about a year ago when the Israeli spy scandal had just broken, and a lot has happened since then. Namely, three men have been indicted, Larry Franklin, Steve Rosen, and Keith Weissman. And you've got a great article that was published on TomPaine.com just in this last week called Bigger Than AIPAC. Very interesting piece that you had there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think before we even get into the specifics of the Israeli spy scandal, I'd like to start out really, first of all, with George Bush on Israeli TV yesterday. Channel 1 TV in Israel did an interview with Bush up at the Crawford Ranch where he said that all options are on the table for dealing with Iran. And the reason I basically want to start with that is because it's become clear now, at least it's been reported in the Washington Post and other places, that the secrets that Larry Franklin was stealing from the Pentagon and giving to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee were documents pertaining to American policy toward Iran. Isn't that right?
That's certainly what we know so far. That's right. They were part of, apparently Franklin was part of a group inside the Pentagon that wanted to adopt a hard line toward Iran.
And, you know, I'm sorry because I know this isn't necessarily your expertise, but I've got to go ahead and get this out on the table. It is perfectly legal for Iran to enrich uranium under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and under the additional protocols which they have signed in addition to their safeguards agreement. There's nothing against anything that Iran ever signed that forbids them from enriching uranium.
No, that's correct. And because they signed the treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they, you know, as part of that arrangement, like any country that signs it, have the right to pursue the nuclear fuel cycle under the appropriate international safeguards. Of course, the problem with Iran is, as they've admitted, they conducted secret research and industrial activity toward building a bomb for many years after the Islamic Republic was established. So the United States and others argue that Iran, you know, can't be trusted, and certainly a number of the people who run that regime are close to lunatics. So I think Iran getting the bomb is not something we want to look forward to with equanimity. On the other hand, the CIA has concluded that they're probably 10 years away from being able to produce a bomb.
And that was if they were to start trying to produce one now. And
right.
I want to go ahead and add real quick here, Bob, before we go out to this first break, that even all the things that they were hiding, they were not required to disclose. As soon as they signed their additional protocol, they opened all their books wide open. So they weren't really being deceitful. They just weren't admitting to everything that had been going on. But in any case, we'll get right back after this break, and we're talking about the Israeli spy scandal and possible war with Iran with Bob Dreyfus on the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with freelance reporter Bob Dreyfus. You can read what he writes at Mother Jones, The American Prospect, Rolling Stone, The Nation, and TomPaine.com. And main topic today really is the Israeli spy scandal, but I know that you're a very well-connected reporter up there in Washington, D.C., Bob, and I really want to know, this is something I've been having a lot of trouble with, is the idea of the likelihood of an American adventure against Iran sometime soon. There have been leaks lately, I'm sure you're familiar with Philip Giraldi's piece in the American Conservative and the different articles that Scott Ritter has written about war plans being made ready, special forces already inside Iran, the Mujahideen al-Khalq being used by the CIA as a terrorist group inside Iran. And I wonder, the people that you talk to, do you get the impression that war with Iran soon is actually likely? Or is this all a lot of bluster?
I don't think war is anything close to imminent with Iran. First of all, we're bogged down in Iraq, and we don't have enough troops even to sustain the fighting in Iraq. We've sort of been scraping the bottom of the barrel to find troops, you know, in various National Guard unit and elsewhere to ship to Iraq. So, we don't have the ability to do anything like an invasion or an attack on Iran in any military sense. Could the Air Force launch attacks against Iranian nuclear facilities? Well, of course. But then the consequences of that, I think, would be disastrous and would probably lead to an escalation that we're not prepared to handle. So I don't think I would say the chances are on a scale from 1 to 10 of, you know, a shooting crisis with Iran is somewhere around 2 now.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you say that, although I noticed that the reasons that you invoke for that conclusion are all very reasonable, you know, logical type conclusions. And I wonder if that's really a fair way to assess the situation being run by Dick Cheney and his ex-Trotskyite comrades in the Pentagon.
Well, I don't know. I don't think that Cheney and company are irrational. I mean, before the war in Iraq, if you looked at it the same way, we did have the troops to attack Iraq, and we did have you know, militarily, we had the forces in place, and we had no-fly zones, and we had, you know, spent a decade thinking about a battle with Iraq, and so it was a completely different situation. And then second, Iraq is a much, much smaller country with a devastated army at the time. Iran is several times larger than Iraq and far more complicated and far more difficult to attack. So just applying, you know, simple military balance kind of analysis, Iraq was attacking a weakened and devastated, you know, enemy that was really a piece of cake, at least as far as, you know, conquering Baghdad and toppling the regime. I don't think that Cheney or anyone else calculated ahead of time the kind of resistance that we're facing now, although certainly he was warned by more knowledgeable people that we'd be, you know, bogged down in a guerrilla campaign and that Iraq would be extremely difficult to stabilize or to govern, especially with the troop levels that we committed. You know, there were people in the army saying we needed at least twice as many troops just to stabilize the place. So based on that, again, I think Iran is just, you know, off the charts too difficult a place for us to you know, try to bite into now. Again, in terms of a strike against its nuclear facilities, I suppose that they might just be dumb enough to try something like that. But again, it seems to me that the process is the slower one now. I mean, if the talks finally break down with Europe and Iran, and if it goes to the Security Council, which is in doubt because China, which depends on the Gulf for a lot of oil, would probably try to block it, as well as perhaps some other countries, Russia, that is. And if the Security Council passed some form of sanctions, which again I think is unlikely given that China would have to go along, and then if Iran continues to defy that for some prolonged period, the United States might start, you know, building up the capability to use this as an excuse to attack Iran. But it, again, I think we're talking about a couple of years down the road.
Oh, well,
in other words, I don't think your listeners ought to be alarmed about war with Iran. I think what they ought to be alarmed about is the crisis in Iraq, which is about to, I would say, in the next 6 months, get so much worse that either the administration is going to have to vastly increase the U.S. effort there, or just pull out with its tail between its legs.
Yeah, well, let's pray for the latter there. And, you know, I'd actually like to get back to the question of Iraq and your new book, Devil's Game, toward the end of the interview here, but we really need to get into the Israeli spy scandal.
Sure.
I understand from reading your article, well, and from reading the new indictment against Rosen and Weissman, that basically Larry Franklin, this isn't the Larry Franklin case. This is the AIPAC case. He just sort of stumbled into the middle of something that had been ongoing for quite some time, right?
Well, yeah, I think the indictment, the way I tried to write about it is it raises a lot more questions than it answers. And, you know, I suspect there's more to come, but we don't know either what or when that might happen. The first question it raises is the indictment says that the investigation of AIPAC began in 1999, in other words, it began during the Clinton administration.
Right, which previously, the earliest we could trace it back before that, I believe, was 2001, right? Richard Sales worked for UPI.
That's right. I mean, I'd never seen anything that indicated that it went back before that. At the end of 2001 is when also Franklin and some of his friends came into the news in terms of dealing with Ghorbanifar and some other Iranians about Iran policy and so forth. But this is the first time, at least in my knowledge, that it was revealed that this investigation went back, you know, fully 5 years from the time that Franklin was indicted in 2004. So it seems that they were surveilling and perhaps wiretapping or otherwise using investigative powers against at least Rosen and Weissman, the two AIPAC officials, going back to 1999.
Now, do you have any idea what began the investigation?
No, I don't have a clue.
But we do know that in order for them to have wiretaps of these officials, they must have had something to show to the FISA judge, right?
That's right. There are two types of investigations. There's criminal and there's intelligence investigations. For the FBI to begin a criminal investigation, they have to go to a judge and show that they have evidence that a crime has been committed. That's, you know, a lot tougher standard. The intelligence investigation with the FISA court, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, is a much easier warrant to get because you simply have to indicate some sort of reasonable suspicion that the person you want to or persons you want to surveil or investigate have ties to a foreign intelligence agency. In other words, you can't just say that they're bad guys of some sort, like, you know, kidnappers. You have to show that they have some sort of apparent connection, and that's what you want to investigate, to an intelligence service of a foreign country. So presumably, in order to get even the warrants to investigate these two AIPAC officials. They'd have to show that one or more foreign countries were involved. Presumably, that would be Israel. But we don't know why these two individuals were selected. We don't know if they were the only two who were being investigated. And we don't know what led to the initial thing. Another thing we don't know, but we have to assume, is that there is a year's worth of surveillance going back to 99. And it wasn't until, I believe, 4 years later that a lunch meeting between these two AIPAC officials and an Israeli embassy official was being watched when Larry Franklin walked into it and sat down.
All right, well, we're going to have to pick up that story where we leave off right after this break, everybody. We're talking with Bob Dreyfus. You can look him up at tompaine.com. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format for downloading later. Also, I write for antiwar.com. You can check out what I write there at antiwar.com/Horton. And I'm talking with Bob Dreyfus. He's a freelance reporter. Most often writes for The Nation, Tom Paine, Mother Jones, The American Prospect, and other places. You can Google his name, Bob Dreyfus, D-R-E-Y-F-U-S-S. And where we left off, sir, was a lunch between Steve Rosen, who, according to the Forward newspaper, was basically the man who built AIPAC's power, his assistant on Iran policy, Keith Weissman. And the FBI is listening into this lunch meeting, and all of a sudden in comes a guy named Larry Franklin who works at the Pentagon. Then what?
Well, apparently the FBI determined that at that meeting and then subsequently, Franklin was trying to unload classified information, documents, and so forth to both the AIPAC officials and the Israeli embassy guy.
And that was Nior Gion, right?
Apparently, yes. I mean, the names aren't given in these indictments, and in fact, Israel isn't even named, but according to press reports and so forth, that's the individual's name. And so on the basis of this chance encounter, I guess, they started investigating Franklin. And after following him and tracking him for a while, as you may know, they pounced on him and threatened him with arrest and indictment, and he began cooperating for a time with the FBI. In other words, they turned him into an agent, basically, and he recontacted some of his various cronies and apparently tried to re-implicate them. And then at a certain point, he stopped cooperating with the FBI, and that's when the first indictment was issued, I guess, toward the end of last year. Then it was amended to include some other charges about him having documents in his home, one of his homes, I think, in West Virginia.
And they even said that he had documents that went back 30 years in there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was really a secondary kind of charge. I mean, almost anybody who works from the government is probably going to have something at home that they've taken. Or, you know, I don't think that was necessarily too serious, at least from what we know, but they just added that in there like they throw the kitchen sink at people when they're trying to go after them.
Right.
But in any case, that wasn't the end of the process, and now they've come out as of, the end of last week, a further amended indictment, which includes the names of Rosen and Weissman and provides an interesting window into some of the other activities that these three guys engaged in. And what I found interesting in it is it says that other persons, both known and unknown to the grand jury that issued this indictment, included several other Israeli officials, Pentagon officials, an official at a Washington think tank, all of whom were involved with, complicit with, engaged in some sort of activity that was part of the Franklin Rosen Weissman indicted activity. Those individuals, at least yet, haven't been indicted, and we don't know even if that's the extent of it or if there's even more people involved.
Is there anything in the wind as to whether or not these unindicted co-conspirators are going to be indicted?
No, I haven't heard anything at all about that, but you never know. As I said, we don't know what the FBI has amassed over 5+ years of surveilling these people. So presumably they've got a warehouse full of tapes and transcripts and material that they've collected in their investigation.
Well, one thing's for sure, that they must not have found anything that implicates Dennis Hastert, because if they had, then they would have brought in the state secrets privilege and gagged everyone and shut down the whole thing.
I didn't know. How did Hastert get involved?
Oh, well, I actually just spent an hour talking with Sibel Edmonds, who's been gagged under the state secrets
privilege. Oh, okay, yeah.
Because
yeah.
She has dirt on the Speaker of the House of Representatives, is why they've invoked national security on her. And so I was just making the comment that it must not be anybody too important, or they would have just shut this whole thing down a long time ago.
Well,
I mean, it's not like the FBI is really interested in the truth.
Well, it depends. Often these things work on the basis of individuals who start an investigation, and once it starts, it can get some momentum. Now, it's certainly true that, once the momentum gets going, there can be, sort of political heavyweight types brought in to shut it down. But if you compare it to Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation of the Valerie Plame leak, so far at least, he seems to be undeterred and pursuing all these leads that go right into the White House itself. So there's a case where you have equally explosive implications.
All right, we're going to have to hold it right there, Bob. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Bob Dreyfus. He's a freelance journalist. You can find the article that we're talking about today, Bigger Than AIPAC, at tompaine.com. And, sir, right before the commercial, I'm really glad you brought up the Plame case, and you were using the example of, like, hey, sometimes a prosecutor gets started and nobody can stop him. That's where all my hopes are right now. But the Plame case really brings up the idea that really all this is one big neocon gate, as Justin Raimondo calls it. This isn't just the AIPAC spy scandal. All these investigations lead directly back to the small group of people inside the Pentagon who were responsible for lying us into war. Is that consistent with what you have found?
Well, yes, except I'm not sure it's such a small group. I think it's a pretty big group of folks. But I would say, as I did in my article, that this Franklin case is like a string that if they pull on it, if the FBI pulls hard enough, it can start to unravel a much, much larger fabric that includes people all over the U.S. government, outside the government, in think tanks and elsewhere, some of whom may be guilty of crimes, most of whom are probably just kind of operate like a fairly arrogant fraternity, where they just assume, well, we're all in this together, we're all partners in this effort, and at least as far as the Iraq war goes, pursued that cause with a kind of single-mindedness going back to the 1990s, and then took advantage of the trauma of 9/11 to press forward with an attack on Iraq, which they probably could never have accomplished had it not been for 9/11. And I guess, you know, going back to your original comment about Iran, if there were another large-scale terrorist attack, you know, that really changes the dynamic completely about Iran, in that you would have the same circle of people then arguing, as they did with Iraq, that Iran is now, you know, al-Qaeda's main sponsor and center of world terrorism. Of course, I believe that's nonsense, but they would probably argue that Iran is now the new Afghanistan or new Iraq, and all bets would be off the table.
Which is what Giraldi wrote in his deep background column, that the Strategic Air Command guys that were leaking to him the fact that they were drawing up plans for full-scale air war, that it was all dependent on another terrorist attack to put the plan in motion.
Yeah, and I think it would have to be, though, a really large-scale terrorist attack. I don't think anything like, you know, some subway bombings, London-style, would be enough to really change, you know, the public's, I think, aversion to war now that Iraq has gone so badly. When Bush went to war in Iraq, like it or not, he clearly had the overwhelming support of both Congress and the public. Certainly he wouldn't have anything like that now vis-a-vis Iran. And I think it would take a lot more than, you know, a couple of dozen dead in a subway bombing or something to change that political calculation.
There's been a lot of hype in the media lately about an impending attack. Do you get the idea in D.C. that people are taking that pretty seriously, or is this just another, hey, watch out, they're going to bomb the Golden Gate Bridge kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of CYA going on in that every, you know, security and intelligence organization, law enforcement group, et cetera, you know, has to protect itself in case there's another attack. I mean, here we are, however, you know, coming up on 4 years after 9/11, and as far as I know, not a single American has been punched in the nose by an Islamic fundamentalist in 4 years. I'm talking about domestically. And so if there's, you know, as Ashcroft, Attorney General Ashcroft said after 9/11, if indeed there were 5,000 al-Qaeda sleepers in the United States in 2001, either they all, you know, had simultaneous heart attacks and died, or that was complete fiction. And I kind of believe the latter. So it doesn't seem like, and certainly not that I've heard, that there's been a single shred of credible evidence of a live plot against the United States. A lot of this is based on rumor, suspicion, you know, and in the case of that ludicrous information that was uncovered in somebody's laptop in Afghanistan about the Prudential building in Newark, you know, they found information from 3 years ago, and they decided that, you know, there was a live threat against these, the World Bank and so forth. I mean, all of this seems to be partly, you know, just stuff they issue just in case to protect themselves. And I think a great deal of it is political. I think Bush is using the obviously real threat of terrorism, but exaggerating it by, I don't know, 10 or 100-fold because it has tremendous political benefits to the White House. I mean, the one place where Bush's credibility still holds up is that people believe he is protecting us against terrorism. And that was especially true during the 2004 elections when people were beginning to sour even then on the war in Iraq and certainly didn't put much stock in Bush's economic policies and nonsensical plans to privatize Social Security and all of that. Still, they gave Bush a lot of credibility for his anti-terrorism slash war on terrorism policies. And so I think Karl Rove and the other political types in the White House are smart enough to realize that as long as they can continue to hype the terrorism threat, it has political benefits for Bush. And so I think, you know, it's a combination of some real threat, some just sort of, you know, ass covering by the security agencies, and then a big dose of political gamesmanship to, you know, present Bush as our father and protector against this barbarian threat that we're facing.
Right, yeah, nothing more powerful than the state, than fear.
Yeah, and you know, there's a legitimate threat, but to put it in perspective, it seems very unlikely that they could replicate 9/11 with airplanes. I don't think they have any access to anything like weapons of mass destruction. You know, could they attack shopping malls or do a truck bomb somewhere? Well, of course. I mean, Tim McVeigh did that. You don't need a massive worldwide organization to build a truck bomb. As far as we know, Tim McVeigh did it with maybe one or two helpers. So, yes, we could have a truck bomb. We could have some other sorts of terrorism in the United States, some suicide bombs, but nothing like, you know, something that could threaten our broader national security. So you put that in perspective, you know. I mean, how many people die in gunshots or car accidents or from smoking every year? It's you know, tens or hundreds of thousands. So I think we have to put the terrorism threat in perspective. And the politicians, at least the ones in the White House, have every reason to want to distort that perspective.
Right. Now, something that jumped out at me when preparing for this show yesterday, I was reading the indictments of the AIPAC spies, and also I was reading the new Vanity Fair article, An Inconvenient Patriot, about Sybil Edmonds. And I stumbled upon this point of convergence that kind of freaked me out a little, just a little bit, when in this article about Sybil, they talk about people at the State Department and people at the Department of Defense being in on this cronyism with the American-Turkish Council. And just now, in the last hour when I interviewed Sybil, I pointed out that it's interesting. Here you have some unnamed Department of Defense officials and State Department officials. Is this connected in any way to AIPAC? And she said, quote, absolutely, that her story is connected to the AIPAC scandal. And according to her, and I don't remember her exact words on this point, but she said her story, when the truth finally does come out, is going to be a lot bigger than the AIPAC scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And will dwarf it. So that's the kind of thing that really gets me. And, of course, she's under gag order. So when I asked her, ooh, was it David Wilmser? Was it John Bolton? She's not allowed to answer. But it will be interesting to see if Sybil Edmonds is ever allowed to reveal the truth of what she knows to us, that she's been trying to say for years now, just exactly what sort of convergence exists between these two stories. Are we dealing again with this group of neocons in the Pentagon?
Yeah, well, like everybody else, I'm kind of waiting to see where this goes. I found it interesting in reading the indictment that Franklin asked Rosen and Weitzman to help him get a job at the White House. And they said that they would, and that they would make some calls to see if they could make it happen.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, that's an interesting example that, and again, this is not hearsay. This was actually a story that was recounted in the indictment of the three men.
And, of course, that implies they've got somebody on the inside at the White House who could put him on the National Security Council.
Right. Now, of course, that's how Washington works. Everybody knows everybody, and you know somebody. But this is more like, well, here they've cultivated Franklin. They've been, you know, wining and dining him. They've been giving him little gifts. They've been sort of, you know, developing him as a source. And now they're saying that they can use their influence in the White House to get him a job there. Well, of course, you know, you'd love to put one of your agents, if that's indeed what Franklin was, or at least quasi-agents, you know, take him out of the Pentagon where his usefulness is limited, I guess, to put him right into the middle of the White House. So that's one small example of the kind of multi-levels of this investigation. The same thing goes with the indictment talks about an American think tank in Washington where they contacted an official there, I believe, in 2003 and asked that individual about some of the information that Franklin had given them, and think tank individual said, I'll look into it. Now, they don't name either the think tank or the person involved, but there are only two, maybe three think tanks in Washington, and certainly the American Enterprise Institute comes to mind, where these guys have, you know, used AEI as almost a base of operations. And I've been to many, many events at AEI over the years, and especially in the last few years, I remember seeing several people from the Pentagon, including Larry Franklin and Michael Rubin and Harold Rode, the three of those individuals sitting in the front row at AIPAC events and whispering like long-lost friends to the people up on the panel, people like Jim Woolsey or Richard Pearl or others, Newt Gingrich and so forth.
And there's only so many people who were in the Office of Special Plans and then went back to AEI. Sounds like it's got to be Michael Rubin or somebody very close to him.
I don't remember that they said that they went back to AEI in this indictment, but Rubin at the time was a Defense Department official, and so was Harold Rode, and so was Larry Franklin, and the three of them, you know, were sort of like peas in a pod and, you know, spent time together, and so you would assume that, and of course they're not the only people, it was a, you know, fairly hefty group of like-minded neoconservatives at the Pentagon, but certainly those would be among the first people you'd start to think about questioning if you wanted to find out, you know, who were Larry Franklin's allies. And obviously the FBI has tapes and surveillance photos and so forth of Franklin and the two AIPAC officials talking with and meeting these Pentagon officials, so the FBI knows who they are. And they're just not prepared yet, you know, to either to name them or to indict them.
Also, Bob, you've written in The Nation. I know Julian Borger has written in The Guardian, James Bamford in his book, A Pretext for War. My interview with Philip Giraldi on July 26th, and Karen Kotowski has... she has not come right out and implied, but she has at least told a story that would seem to indicate the truth of your assertion and Borger's assertion that there was a little Office of Special Plans that had been created in Israel to help the guys at the American Office of Special Plans come up with the lies to justify war.
Yeah, well, you know, like the United States, where there was a war among the agencies and where the Pentagon was, you know, almost at war with the CIA and the State Department. The same was true in Israel. Israel was not exactly united on policy toward Iraq or Iran or anything else. And so I think, I mean, what I've been told by experts is that the Israeli Mossad and most of its real intelligence people didn't believe that Saddam Hussein was an urgent threat.
Well, I'm sorry, Bob. We're going to have to hold you right there as we go into this break. We'll be right back, everybody. We're talking with Bob Dreyfus. You'll know him at TomPaine.com.
Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Bob Dreyfus about an article that he wrote for TomPaine.com called Bigger Than AIPAC. Everybody keep your eyes peeled for just in a couple of months. His new book will be out, Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and hopefully we'll have a tiny bit of time at the very end to talk about that. But right before we were going out to break there, sir, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, and you were talking about the Office of Special Plans and its ties to a similar rump intelligence unit in Ariel Sharon's office.
Yeah, what I was saying is Israel, like the United States, was divided, and I believe that there were people in Israel, especially in Prime Minister Sharon's own sort of prime minister's office, that were sort of on the same wavelength as the people in the United States who were pressing for an immediate attack on Iraq. And as you know, the CIA and a lot of other people here were against the war. And similarly in Israel, there were a lot of people who thought it was pretty dumb to open up that can of worms. So there was kind of this a parallel factional fight within Israel as there was in the United States over whether Saddam was a serious threat. And so, you know, I think it's more correct to look at it as kind of a cross national factional alliance between people in our country and people in Israel and in Europe and elsewhere who were pushing for this attack on Iraq.
Well, I'm not sure what you might make of this, but I just feel like going ahead and saying it anyway. I interviewed Philip Giraldi here filling in for the Boss's show on July 26th, and he confirmed to me that it was Michael Ledeen and two former CIA officers, friends of his, who forged the Niger documents. Or I guess the officers did the forging, and it was Michael Ledeen who brought those forged documents to Italy to be funneled back up through the stovepipe of intelligence. You know anything more about that?
No, I don't. I mean, everyone's speculating about, you know, who might have produced those.
I think Giraldi seemed to know who produced them.
Well, I suppose. I mean, I don't know if he knows. He knows more than I do. I'm suspicious that it's as simple as that because, obviously, they were produced, you know, extremely poorly, and I know Michael Ledeen. He's a pretty smart guy. And so exactly why he would produce documents that were such obvious forgeries, you know, I mean, they were just the people who took a look at them, who knew anything about it, in about 4 seconds realized that they were fake. They were on the wrong kind of letterhead, and they had officials' names wrong, and the dates were wrong, and, you know, everything about them was dumb. It was like some third grader forged them. So,
in fact, Seymour Hersh wrote an article where he speculated, or some people had speculated to him, that perhaps these were created by CIA guys in order to embarrass the neocons, to trick them into using it.
Yeah, I've seen that too. That seems a little, you know, too Machiavellian. Although certainly whoever created them didn't realize they'd be that important later on.
Right.
In other words, you create these, you know, terrible, dumb-looking documents, and you assume that someone's going to find them and ridicule them, and exactly why they ended up being taken so seriously and then becoming, you know, the basis for a statement in the President's State of the Union address, that's still a mystery to me. But certainly the people who created them could not have hoped for getting that much play out of these really badly forged documents.
Okay, everybody, the Larry Franklin trial is scheduled to start September the 6th. And you can keep up with what Bob Dreyfus writes at TomPaine.com. Thanks a lot for your time, Bob.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.